It's Michelle Pinbeck from International Institute of Environment and Development.
Good afternoon, everyone. What I was proposing to talk about was how to reframe DFID's approach to food farming and development. My talk is in three parts. I'd first like to talk about some of the key assumptions underlying DFID's approach to food farming and development and suggest that they're deeply problematic. Second, outline some possible organizing principles for a new approach for food and farming, and then suggest some recommendations for DFID's policy and practice. I think one of the first assumptions that we have to look at critically is this linear view of development and assumptions about progress, that development is seen as a process in which fewer and fewer people live off the land and water-based livelihood, that there's migration to urban areas, and that's a good thing. But more importantly, the assumption that history can repeat itself, that the process that we experienced in the West of the primary sector becoming smaller, then moving to manufacture, and then the service sector will actually repeat itself in other parts of the world in a changed economy. I think that it's become increasingly clear that there's a direct relationship between the vast increases in productivity achieved through re-engineering, the introduction of automated technology, downsizing and total quality management on the one hand, and the permanent exclusion of high numbers of people from employment, both in industry and the service sector. This is a new situation in the world context. And for that reason, I think that assumption needs to be revisited. A second assumption is that economic productivity is the key yardstick to guide and measure positive change in agriculture and the food system. A kind of one-dimensional emphasis on productivity, which leads one to underplay the importance of new concepts that are informing agricultural thinking, the concept of multifunctionality of agriculture and land use, in which people who live off the land are seen as producers of not only food, nutrition, and food security, depending on their social arrangements, but also producers of culture, of landscapes, of biodiversity, a much more comprehensive, holistic understanding of the multiple functions of agriculture, in which economic productivity is important, but it's only one element. And I think that new thinking is pretty crucial. A third assumption is that money-based markets are the way forward. There's an emphasis on market-based solutions to meet food and other human needs, and no or very little thinking outside the box. A kind of reduction of economic exchange to money-based markets. And yet in many of the societies several of us interact, we know that there are other forms of economic exchange where the money-based economy sits side by side with barter markets, subsistence-oriented markets, and solidarity-based markets, which are all structured through other values of reciprocity, exchange, and they have nothing to do with the parameters used by economists. So let me talk a little bit about a new approach to food and agriculture, and I'd like to be blunt here. I think it's basically a new approach would have to recognize that there's basically a conflict between centralized, corporate-driven, export-oriented industrial agriculture and a fairly predatory global system versus more decentralized, peasant and family farm-based sustainable production, primarily oriented to domestic markets. And a new approach to food and agriculture would recognize that family farm and peasant-based production throughout the world accounts for 90% of world food production, much of which does not pass through formal markets. And the international agricultural trade element represents only 10% of world agricultural production, and most of the benefits of that trade are captured by large corporations that control commodity chains in different parts of the global food system. So a new approach to food and agriculture needs to think about shifts from uniformity, concentration, coercion and centralization to support approaches that build much more on diversity, decentralization, democratization, and dynamic adaptation to different contexts. The need to also think about policies and practices that generally empower the weak and marginalized to regain control over resources and regulative institutions, remembering that empowerment has the corollary that while some people gain power, other players lose power. And I think one way of imagining other policies is to apply quite systematically these principles to rethink policies, practice, and organizational cultures. So let me suggest some key areas for DFID's guidelines and its support for agricultural development policies and practice. One which is, I think, pretty fundamental is the whole area of addressing the democratic deficit in the way policies are formulated, the way knowledge is validated, the way technologies are developed for food and farming. So it's about democratizing science, technology, and policy processes. It's about creating arenas where expert knowledge is put under public scrutiny to help redress the power imbalances that exist between elite social groups and ordinary citizens. And there are a whole set of methodologies and processes that can allow one to do that, to create safe spaces with proper safeguards to ensure that the processes are credible, plural, transparent, and trustworthy. Citizen juries, scenario workshops. There's a whole raft of processes that come under the heading of deliberative and inclusive processes that could be used for democratic deliberation and citizen empowerment. It's about broadening citizen and non-specialist involvement in framing policies, setting research agendas, and validating knowledge. It's also about extended peer review, involving citizens as well as holders of specialist knowledge. Quite a revolution in the way decisions are made, but it's needed if we're serious about voice, inclusion, and making the priorities and views of the poor count. That process also implies companion initiatives to block the influence of powerful actors on the formulation of policies. Policies of full disclosure of funding sources to identify and overcome conflicts of interest, making sure that potential members of government advisory committees, regulatory bodies, are not admitted if they have financial and commercial ties with industry. It also means ensuring that the funding of research, both for the social and natural sciences, and policy formulation, are fully funded by public sources, and not from business and corporate-sponsored policy think tanks. McKinsey formulated Vision 2020 in Andhra Pradesh. Currently, Syngenta Foundation is formulating the agricultural policy of Mali. There's something to do there. Let me move on to the specific area of farming, production, and agriculture system management. Very important focus on supporting the conditions for sustainable food and agricultural systems, recognizing that sustainable agriculture and food systems are generated through the interaction of resource-conserving technologies that involve local institutions, local groups in their development, their validation, and external organizations acting in the facilitating mode, as well as a set of enabling policy frameworks, legal, regulatory, and other policy frameworks. So I'd love to take in turn these different elements, the resource-conserving technologies and land use. There's a wide range of proven resource-conserving technologies and practices for soil, pest management, nutrient management, and water management. And in complex risk-prone agriculture, the adoption of these regenerative technologies has doubled or trebled yields, with little use of external inputs in many cases. In industrial and green revolution farming, the adoption of these regenerative technologies have either maintained yields and reduced input, or they have resulted in yield drops, 10 to 20% in the short term, but they've led to higher financial returns for farmers. Now, behind these practices, there are sets of science which deal with complexity, with landscape management, with agroecosystem dynamics, with agroecology, and those areas of science need to receive much, much more attention. And when I mention agroecology, I refer to processes that try and design agricultural systems in such a way that they minimize the need for the use of external inputs supplied by the supplier of those inputs. A lot of science and technology is designed to create new markets. And we can actually have science that reverses that process, that builds on autonomy, self-reliance, and independence, which many farmers aspire to, both in the north and the south. And they're very elegant technologies. They're very elegant systems. I've heard a lot of talk whereby these systems are primitive, ascientific, and so on. I think that's a misconception. They draw on bodies of knowledge in the scientific community that deal with complexity, chaos theory, broad system stuff, and they often combine indigenous knowledge. And that area needs much, much more attention because of their potential to reduce the cost of production and also generate more multifunctional forms of agriculture and land use that often include high levels of biodiversity, genetic species and ecosystem diversity, and valorize indigenous knowledge in the process. The third area I want to talk about the need to strengthen local institutions and civil society. It's striking that in a lot of the documents I've read, there's an emphasis on the state and the market, and somewhere the citizen, civil society, is assumed to play a passive role in policies, in agricultural life. That's, you know, clearly at odds with a lot of our experience. But it needs to be stated. A lot of the regenerative technologies that can be used in different parts of the food system depend on group action, coordinated action, and that's where local institutions are needed. Local platforms for resource management, local platforms for new forms of marketing are tremendously important. All of which help with collective decision-making and coordinated action over large areas. Similarly, if we're talking about scaling up technologies or market innovations, the crucial role played by federations of farmers, forest dwellers, fisher folk is very, very important for spreading, scaling up innovations, be they technologies, marketing, and rural-urban linkages. That clearly needs to be stressed. And finally, in terms of political negotiation and the expression of countervailing power, the role of social movements and federations in negotiation processes is very, very important. And clearly there is a need to strengthen civil society on all those accounts. Let me move on now to the question of enabling bureaucracies and the need for professional orientation. This way of working presupposes that the public sector and external organizations do actually behave quite differently, use quite different methodologies. And it's a whole issue of bureaucratic transformation, of making organizations much more enabling to deal with the complexity they're faced with, moving away from the sort of top-down technology transfer systems and the associated values, organizational cultures, organizational procedures, structures, reporting systems, and so on. A huge area there which DFID has supported in the past, but could do a lot more in its new strategy. Then I'd like to move to the policy areas. Clearly, DFID can play a very good catalytic role in those areas. Two levels, in terms of the kinds of policies it encourages development of at the national level, but also what it does in the multilateral arena. So let me talk first about national policies that need support. Clearly the area of property rights, land reform, redistribution of surplus land to tenants, and within a rights-based approach to development, not a market-based approach, a rights-based approach to development. Reform of property rights to secure gender equitable rights of access and use to forests, to water, and many other resources that matter to the poor. Then the whole area of intellectual property rights protection, the recognition that the innovations, the intellectual innovations, the intellectual property of ordinary farmers, indigenous people, do need to be protected and recognized. On the broader economic policies, we need to look at ways of reintroducing protective safeguards for domestic economies to guarantee stable prices that cover the cost of production. This is crucial. We know that a lot of peasant economies and societies are simply devastated when cheap food is dumped on their economies, and farmers simply are unable to produce food to cover their cost of production. They can't even sell, in many cases, their food on local markets simply because of the flooding problem. The EU subsidized food from the EU, flooding markets in West Africa. It's had tragic consequences. So clearly a need to rethink and be bold in terms of introducing control on imports, tariffs, quotas, and reactivating that debate. Look with that policies that guarantee prices to producers and consumers as well as the safety net to the poor. Subsidies have a bad name because of their links with dumping, overproduction, but subsidies are important. Small farmers often need subsidies to buy the bullocks they need, they must have to regenerate their land with organic manure. Many farming communities also would probably use subsidies to set up local radios, to use media to communicate and extend their ideas across the land. There's a place for subsidies at that level, but it's a matter of redirecting those subsidies, both hidden and direct, towards supporting small-scale producers that encourage shifts towards more diverse, ecological, equitable, and more localized food systems. And of course, there's the whole area of increasing public support for research and development and agricultural extension towards participatory approaches and democratic control over priority setting, technology validation, and the spread of innovation. Now let's look globally. I think it was your minister, Hilary Benn, who was talking at a SARA meeting recently about the need for a global multilateralism. I think that's very true, and there is certainly a role for DFID there. And again, let me be bold here and suggest that there's a lot of work in terms of finding ways of reorienting the end goals of trade rules and aid so that they contribute to building local economies and local control rather than international competitiveness. We'll hear later about the story tale of Vision 2020 in Andhra Pradesh, a tale of what international competitiveness implies for people, for very poor people and the land, and national sovereignty. Then the whole area of supply management, very, very important. Measures that are introduced to manage supplies, the total output of food and fiber on markets, to ensure that public support does not lead to overproduction and dumping that lower prices below the cost of production. Harming farmers both in the south and the north. There are many examples of farmers in the north, for example. And we know also that there are very high suicide rates associated with this. And within the same country, parts of the United States to another part of the United States. And the suicide rates among American farmers are said to be 3 times higher than in prisons. These are realities. And that they're not statistics told to this, they're realities. Linked with these questions of supply management, there's a whole area where DFID could play an extremely valuable role in renegotiating international commodity agreements to regulate total outputs on world food markets and fiber markets. Very, very important. I want to mention the particular role of corporations, transnational corporations in the food system. They merit close attention and a number of actions aimed at clearly and consciously limiting their economic clout and their ability to define production standards and organize production and consumption. So there's an agenda of restricting the concentration and market power of major agri-food corporations through new international treaties, competition laws, and the adoption of more flexible process and product standards. This is the key area. If we look at how power is distributed in the food system, these are the key players. They need attention. Empowerment means that some gain power, others lose power. And this is something that has to be built in any meaningful, relevant agricultural policy for the 21st century. Linked with that, there's a need for much greater international collaboration for more effective antitrust law enforcement and measures that reduce market concentration in different parts of the global food system, seeds, pesticides, retailing, and using criminal law. Corporations and their directors should be held legally responsible for breaches in environmental and social standards and international agreements. Donors really have to have the balls to engage with these particular areas. They're questions of accountability, transparency, and leveling the economic playing field for the poor, and opening the possibilities of maybe a plurality of agricultural development models rather than a single development model, which is taken as the main reference point in a lot of these discussions. But let me just summarize. The areas I'm talking about for DFID guidelines and DFID policies are to do, one, with democratizing the governance of food and farming, the recognition of the value of plural stocks of knowledge for sustainable food and farming, agroecology and resource-conserving technologies, the need to strengthen local institutions, federations of the poor, and new social movements, transforming bureaucracies and the agenda of capacity building to reorient professional practice, enabling national and international policies for equity and ecological sustainability, and corporate regulation and accountability. Thank you.